Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 5th of June. Today, Gordon Brown attempts to quell a rebellion as Labour prepares for poor results in the local and European elections.
He's been calling rebels and would-be rebels to try and explain his position, encourage them to stay on side. We don't know how menacing those calls have been.
Also today, Barack Obama addresses the concerns of Muslims around the world, telling Israel it's time for the settlements to stop.
He was enunciating general principles in a very laudable way: transparency, confidence in equal administration, justice, the freedom to choose. He says those are not just American ideas, they're human rights, and that's why we will support them everywhere.
And fresh evidence of the evolution of laughter. Stop sniggering at the back, because here's Bill Overton with the news and a flick through the papers.
Another cabinet minister's resigned within minutes of the polls closing in the European and local elections. He's the Work and Pensions Secretary James Purnell, the third cabinet minister to leave the government in as many days. In a resignation letter, he called on Gordon Brown to quit himself to give the Labour Party what he called a fighting chance. He says he now believes the PM's leadership makes a Conservative victory more, not less, likely. Conservative leader David Cameron says the Labour Party's falling apart in front of our eyes. Several ministers and MPs have responded with public support for Gordon Brown, saying he's still the right man to lead the country through the present challenges. But the resignation gives a boost to a campaign among backbench MPs to get the PM to resign. The Guardian's learned they now believe they have the support of at least 75 Labour MPs. The first results in the local elections show big falls for Labour. The Conservatives won control of the new unitary authority of central Bedfordshire as Labour failed to win a single seat. In Bristol, the party lost 8 out of its 10 contested council seats as the Liberal Democrats took control of the city. There was also voting in Britain and some other countries yesterday in the election for the European Parliament. The results aren't announced until the end of the weekend, but exit polls in the Netherlands show a steep rise for the right wing. The Freedom Party is led by Geert Wilders, who was banned from visiting Britain for his racist views. The exit polls show his party's come second in Holland with 15% of the vote. It's the Times that has the full story of James Purnell's resignation, carrying his letter on its front page. He writes from his Department for Work and Pensions, saying, "The party was here long before us, and we want it to be here long after we've gone. We must do the right thing by it." The Sun also has the letter and its headline, reading, "I quit, now you quit," calling the resignation a bombshell for Gordon Brown. The Guardian calls Purnell the smooth assassin, saying there's now a serious likelihood other members of the cabinet will break ranks. It follows the backbench rebellion in detail, reporting it now has to be taken more seriously by Number 10, which had been calling it a peasant's revolt. The Express: Brown faces revolt today once the local election results all come in. The paper says rebel MPs and ministers are poised to strike a killer blow, but that Mr. Brown is obstinately determined not to stand down. Finally, The Telegraph reports the Queen's being urged to press for election if PM goes. It claims if Gordon Brown's forced from office by his own party, some constitutional experts believe the monarch should dissolve Parliament rather than have another unelected Prime Minister. Only three papers choose a different story for their front page leads: The Mail and The Mirror, reporting the case of the two French students savagely tortured to death, as The Mail puts it. The Mirror calls it the scandal of the mad dog killer, after one of the convicted murderers turned out to have been released from prison by mistake. And The Independent focuses on Barack Obama's speech in Cairo, saying that it was made of words that could heal the wounds of centuries. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Gordon Brown's fate hangs in the balance today as the extent of voters' anger against Labour becomes clear. The recent turmoil at Westminster was temporarily becalmed yesterday for polling in the local and European elections. But with the elections out of the way, the Prime Minister is again open to attack. He'd been left clinging to his job after Wednesday's surprise resignation of the Community Secretary Hazel Bleers. And Will Woodward, the Guardian's head of politics, says Labour's braced for a bad result from yesterday's elections.
They certainly will be pleased to come second behind the Conservatives. They could very well come third behind the Liberal Democrats, and they might even come fourth behind UKIP. I mean, this is a really unusual situation we're in. There's talk that Labour could head lower than 20%, which would be very, very difficult for Gordon Brown. The curious thing about today is, although we've got a smaller sample of voters in that we've only got the local election results today, and people in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland would have been voting in the European elections. In some ways, this is a better barometer because it's people voting in a kind of old-style first-past-the-post system. So it's much clearer who they're choosing, and we're anticipating that Labour will come out very badly from this.
There was a temporary cessation in hostilities yesterday while polling took place. But Gordon Brown's been taking some steps to shore up support for himself. What's been going on?
As we understand it, he's been calling rebels and would-be rebels to try and explain his position, encourage them to stay on side. We don't know how menacing those calls have been. Also, I think there's talk in government of trying to look forward beyond the sort of blizzard of results we're about to go into and do things like, promote. I think they need to promote much more clearly their programme of constitutional reform, make them much more explicit what that means to your average voter. And obviously they need to keep talking about the economy, and they need to keep talking about things other than the two big crises, if you like, constitutional and economic crisis. You really got to see him getting on the front foot a bit more on things like the public services.
There's also going to be a reshuffle. It's an opportunity for Brown to bring, I guess, some of the potential rebels on side, but it's also a moment that could be make Gordon Brown look particularly vulnerable.
Yes, I mean, that's been the extraordinary thing over the last few days. Not all reshuffles go well. I mean, I remember Tony Blair's going quite badly at times. The thing about Blair's was they didn't go badly on the day, and there would be a ricket, something he didn't expect, so he'd have to make sort of a hurried decision, which meant you got a few odd moves. I rather think Margaret Beckett becoming Foreign Secretary, for instance, was one of those. But with Brown, you've had the reshuffle sort of falling apart before it's even begun, with the resignation on Wednesday of Hazel Blears, the resignation or the announcement of the resignation of Jackie Smith on Tuesday. And it does make life very difficult for him. I mean, we'll wait and see, but the position of Alistair Darling, the Chancellor, I think is particularly interesting. He's made it pretty clear he doesn't want to be moved. And if he goes, if Brown insists on moving him and Darling resigns, then that's a very, very big moment for the government.
Will Woodward, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, John Vidal on the start of the crop circle season, guardian.co.uk/G2 for that. Whatever happened to Blair's babes? Madeleine Bunting on a bad week for women and politics. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And the return of the charity shop is considered at guardian.co.uk/life and style. Dano Sonex, who was 23 and from Peckham, and Nigel Farmer, who was 34, of no fixed address, begin life sentences today after being convicted of the savage murder of two French students. Laurent Bonomo and Gabrielle Ferrez, who were both 23, were tied up, tortured, and left with 244 stab wounds at their South East London flat, which was then set on fire. After the convictions, it was revealed that there'd been grave failings in the handling of the case that led to the resignation of London's Chief Probation Officer David Scott in February. Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, has personally apologised to the victims' families. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
Well, there's some extraordinary blunders by nearly every part of the criminal justice system in this case. First of all, as long ago as May 2004, a prison medical doctor, when he was in Sonics, was in Portland Young Offender Institution, admitted to the doctor that he could kill. And he said in his prison medical report, his doctor said he had strong feelings about this fellow, that it will come under the orbit of psychology, explore levels of his dangerousness, which I already predict are high, given his record of violence, lack of remorse or pity, a number of adjudications in his record. The forensic dimension is of greatest concern, especially as he admits that his reactions could kill. Unfortunately, this assessment wasn't seem to have been shared with any prison or probation staff subsequently who made assessments of him. There was confusion over his dangerousness when he was released from prison in February, and one prison computer system, he was deemed to be a high-risk offender who should have attracted the highest level of supervision, but on his probation computer system, he was regarded only as a medium-risk offender, and so therefore didn't come under the guise of the public protection unit in Lewisham. 2 days after he released, he was involved in an attack upon a 5-month pregnant woman and her boyfriend, where he hooded her and threatened her and her boyfriend with a knife and a hammer. The two people involved were too scared of reprisals to push any charges in this case, and so no action was taken against Sonics. As a result of that, he was only given a verbal warning instead of being recalled for prison. When it was finally decided to recall him to prison because he'd on the charge of handling stolen goods, it then took 33 days for that recall warrant to be issued after amidst confusion between the probation service and court officials. And finally, even when the recall notice was finally issued by the court after more than a month, the police didn't do anything about it for 16 days. And they finally visited the address they had for Sonics 2 hours, unfortunately, after the killings had happened.
And what steps have been taken by the authorities to ensure there's no repeat of these grave failings, as we saw in this case?
Well, there have been no fewer than 5 different internal investigations reports for the probation service and an inquiry by the Independent Police Complaints Commission into that last failure by the police to go and look for Sonics when an arrest warrant had been issued. As a result of those reports, the Chief Probation Officer for London, David Scott, in February was given the choice by Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, of going through a performance capability review. He decided instead to offer his resignation, which was accepted, and so the Chief Probation Officer of London has already resigned and a police sergeant has been disciplined. As for Lewisham Probation Office, where most of these failings took place, his case officer at the time was a woman who was newly qualified as a probation officer, only 9 months' experience, and had a caseload of 127 offenders on her books at the time. They've had further staffing and further shake-ups in Lewin, London.
The probation union, NAPO, says ministers must take responsibility for failing to adequately fund the criminal justice system. Is there an element here of political responsibility that needs to be taken?
Jack Straw, in his response to this case, has said that resources are not the issue, but his own internal investigation report says understaffing was a key factor in the case. It does seem as though this is a false argument between management failures on the one hand and resources on the other. The probation service says as Mr. David Scott, who has been forced to resign over it, has said, is in danger of becoming a Cinderella service amongst the public services. And it seems to be that there must be a case of the resources of the probation service not keeping up with the ever-increasing demands of trying to deal with offenders outside of already crowded prisons.
There are echoes of the Baby P case here, aren't there?
There are indeed, in terms of levels of chaotic organisation in public service. In this case, though, Jack Straw has taken every step to ensure that he's tried to deflect the damage, if you like, before the end of the trial. So he has personally met the parents of both the two French students and apologised to them in person. He's taken action as regards the Chief London Probation Officer. And so he's not in the same position that Ed Balls was when the Baby P court case ended, where he then had to negotiate the dismissal of Sharon Shoesmith in the full public glare and was reacting after the event. Straw seems to have fixed it to a certain extent in advance.
Alan Travis. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in today's show, we get the inside story in the contest to become the next Oxford Poetry Professor.
Rooty Tooty was my motive. I was haughty. She was naughty. She was pouting. I was doubting. Men were shouting the odds, the sods.
But first, Barack Obama offered a new start yesterday to relations between America and the Muslim world.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world. One based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And one based upon the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap and share common principles. Principles of justice and progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings.
The director of Israel's government press office, Danny Seaman, said Obama's speech was not bad. As President Obama admitted, no single speech can eradicate years of mistrust, but the Muslim world largely welcomed the address. Ian Black, our Middle East editor, said the president made all the right noises.
I thought it was a very good speech. I thought, in general terms, his call for a new beginning and the talk of peace and understanding and mutual comprehension and not being defined by differences, I thought that was all really powerful stuff, and it was delivered with passion and precision in a setting that was very appropriate and will have, I think, a huge resonance.
It was classic Barack Obama, wasn't it?
It was a classic Barack Obama. It was a terrific performance. It was much more, however, about tone than substance. I think the tone was very important because all the things we've just mentioned were there. You know, tolerance, mutual understanding, an end to bigotry, a determination to fight violence, and all those things. Where I think it will disappoint some people was that there were very few specifics on the hot button issues that people care about in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Again, the tone on Israel and the Palestinians, on Iran, on democracy, on women's rights, and all those things, on the place of Muslims in American culture, that was all good stuff. But on the policy questions, there was really nothing very much new. And I think in the Arab world in particular, in the countries that are close to and obsessed by the Palestinian issue, I think that although the message to Israel on settlement was strong, as has come out in the last few days, the overall the absence of any concrete proposals will be seen to be a drawback, I think, though, you know, the speech has only ended a few minutes ago, and we shall have to see.
And yet he did confront some of the most difficult issues that divide Americans and the Muslim and Arab world head on.
He confronted them, but he also sidestepped them to some extent. For example, when he talked about democracy in the Arab world, he talked about democracy passionately, about the rule of law and accountable government and not taking votes for granted and then ruling for life. But he didn't mention any countries. He didn't mention Egypt, for example, where, of course, he was giving the speech, which is an authoritarian country where the political system is a sort of facade, really, of democracy and ruled by a president for life who has very little tolerance for the sort of ideals that Obama was talking about. So he was enunciating general principles in a very laudable way: transparency, confidence in equal administration, justice, the freedom to choose. He says those are not just American ideas, they're human rights, and that's why we will support them everywhere. But what support was far less than clear in real terms. That's the sort of gap, I think, between the laudable rhetoric that everybody can sign up to and any kind of reality. He also gave Obama a very, very strong defense of America's unbreakable relationship with Israel. That's the sort of language that raises hackles in the Arab world. He rightly, I think, and courageously attacked what he called baseless, ignorant, and hateful denial of the Nazi Holocaust. That's, of course, aimed very much at the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But he also, you know, he used powerful language for the Palestinians, too. He described their life under occupation as intolerable. At the same time, he, you know, called on Hamas, the Islamist movement in Gaza, to abandon violence. So, you know, there's some powerful words there, but very little in the way of concrete policies. But, you know, as you say, Obama had made that point himself. A single speech couldn't be expected to change anything. The tone was impressive, certainly.
Ian Black in Cairo. Anyone who's seen that film of Boris Johnson falling in a river, and if you haven't, it's at guardian.co.uk/politics/London, will have allowed themselves a chuckle. But new research reveals that we've been laughing for a lot longer than that, for 10 million years, in fact. The study, led by Dr. Marina Davila Ross from the University of Portsmouth, involved tickling babies, both apes and humans, and recording their reactions. And as Ian Sample, our science correspondent, explains, it suggests that laughter isn't a trait exclusive to humans.
This researcher travelled around zoos in Europe and also went off to a reserve in Borneo and recorded the sounds that various species of great ape made while they were being tickled. And so, and different apes like being tickled in different places, different individuals like being tickled in different places. So some of them would sort of make noises when they're tickled on their neck, some on their feet, some under the armpits, and some of them apparently were offering their feet to be tickled for this particular experiment. And she recorded all the sound files and then got a load of laughing noises from babies as well.
And we've got some of them here. Let's compare and contrast. First, this is a human baby. This is a bonobo. Now let's hear a chimpanzee. And a gorilla. Ian, what does this research tell us about laughter?
Well, what's really interesting here is they took these different sound files, and as you would have heard, they actually sound very different. I mean, human laugh is very characteristic, very distinctive to us. But these other noises, I mean, sometimes people, you know, don't even think it's an animal that's doing it if you play them blind to people. But what these researchers did is they took all these different noises that are made by primates when they're tickled, and they put them into a program that usually deals with evolutionary problems. So it's a kind of program you put things into to arrange species on an evolutionary tree. So over time, how one species have evolved into another and how they've branched off and all the rest of it. What's interesting with this is that if you put these sound files into that evolutionary program, the kind of evolutionary tree it comes up with based purely on the acoustics is you get a sort of a tree of life, which looks exactly the same as the genetic one. So in that case, you would have humans being very close to chimps and bonobos, but very different to orangutans, with gorillas somewhere in between.
Do scientists know why we laugh?
Well, there are some theories. I mean, I wouldn't say there's anything conclusive on it, although the individual people will say they know for sure. I mean, some people say when you look at apes, that these kind of noises that you could call laughter are really signs of excitement, of high arousal, as you say. But it also seems to be really important in social animals as a group bonding thing. I think, you know, if these noises are being made, they're often made in playful situations, and it seems to help to bind these groups together.
We can only speculate about why this happened, but when was the first laugh?
What these researchers are doing by creating this evolutionary tree is you can kind of trace back the laugh to the last common ancestor that we shared with these great apes. And that was somewhere between 10 and 16 million years ago. So you could say that the first laugh that sort of rippled across the land was at least 10 million years ago.
Ian Sample, the post of Oxford poetry professor, is one of the most influential positions in UK poetry. It's also been described as one of the most poisonous. Ruth Padell resigned last month after being in the job for just 9 days. It transpired she'd alerted journalists to allegations that her rival for the post, the Nobel Prize winner Derek Walcott, had faced sexual harassment claims back in the 1980s. Padell denied being part of a smear campaign. Well, a fresh election is now underway, with a fresh candidate, The Guardian's Stephen Moss. Here's an example of his work.
I was married to a beauty, flighty, 30, flirty, fluty. I was boring, she was bearing, men were staring. Rooty tooty was my motive, I was haughty, she was naughty. She was pouting, I was doubting, men were shouting the odds, the sods. Said it couldn't last, it didn't blast.
Well, that's fantastic, Stephen. Thanks very much. I mean, me, like many others here at The Guardian, we didn't know that you were a writer of poetry. But great though that is, this position that you're applying for, Oxford Poetry Professor, it's the most senior academic position in British poetry. What special qualities will you bring to this job?
Well, I should say a little bit about my poetry writing first. Am I a poet? I've written poetry, I suppose, since I was about 14. I have always written, but I suppose I wrote... My most fecund period was certainly those first 20 years. I've written fewer poems since. I was at Hay on the evening that Ruth Padell announced that she was resigning, and possibly we'd had rather too much champagne, not Ruth and I, but I and some other people from The Guardian, and I announced that I was would like to stand for the post. And somehow, a week later, I seemed to be applying. And I'm not quite sure how that's happened and whether it's a good idea, but I went along to the Poetry Society with some of my poems, and I thought, well, if they absolutely hate them, I won't go through with it. But they were, for whatever reason, they were actually quite charming about the seven poems I decided I could show them. So here I am carrying on with the process and putting myself forward.
Have you got any skeletons in your cupboard?
Loads of skeletons, which is obviously very wrong. But a key thing is that we should concentrate on the work. And the whole debacle over the Walcott-Padel argument, which has done poetry, obviously it's put poetry into the headlines, but done poetry no good at all. We don't want a repetition of that. So we need to keep private lives entirely out and just concentrate on what one brings to the job in terms of one's work and one's ideas for developing the post. And I've got two big initial ideas. One is to that the £6,000 a year stipend I thought I might offer to poetic ventures and to distressed Oxford graduates, i.e. the people who vote for the post. And second, I'd like the election day, the voting all takes place on the same day. They haven't announced when that will be yet, but it'll be sometime in the autumn or maybe into 2010. And I thought that could be a great sort of that day could be a great sort of celebration of poetry. And I want to set up barrels of Breakspeare's beer outside the Sheldonian Theatre to encourage people to come and vote.
Who votes in this?
People who've graduated from Oxford and who've actually bothered to go through with the official graduation ceremony. You need 12 Oxford graduates to nominate you for the post. And I'm hoping that once I announce my candidature, as I have today, initially this 12 will come forward, and then we can develop the campaign from there.
Well, Stephen, good luck. And let's hear another of your poems before you go.
Okay. This is a rather sadder one called To David Whom I Scarcely Knew. No one tends the flowers outside your window. They have grown stale in the sun. The neighbours have noticed your absence, but only for a moment, then on to forgetful futures. It puts it into perspective, someone said. A useful phrase. You are dead and we are alive. That's the perspective.
Stephen Moss, and you can contact him at stephen.moss@guardian.co.uk to offer support. And he'll be tweeting the odd couplet at twitter.com/BENONIX. And don't forget, you can also follow Guardian Daily on Twitter, twitter.com/Guardian Daily. Roxanne Escobales and Tim Mabey produced Guardian Daily today. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.